The English Civil Wars, 1639 to 1660. The First Battle of Newbury, Part 1. Now, this is the first battle. This battle takes place on September the 20th, 1643, and it's the first battle where King Charles is actually in command. Now, we're going to look at this in two parts. This first part is a lead-up to the Battle of Newbury, and then the second part, next time, we'll cover the battle itself and its aftermath. Now, in this battle, you will have Charles I, Prince Rupert, and Sir John Byron commanding the Royalists, and the Earl of Essex, Philip Skipon, and Philip Stapleton commanding the Parliamentarians. And the two sides are pretty even. 6,000 cavalry and 8,000 infantry for the Royalists, 4,000 cavalry, 10,000 infantry for the Parliamentarians. And the casualties will be about the same as well. 1,300 for the Royalists, 1,200 for the Parliamentarians. So let's look at the introduction, the moving towards the Battle of Newbury. When the war started, and I've talked about this before, both sides expected that it would be settled in just one battle. And by the end of 1642, it was clear that's not what was going to happen. After the inconclusive Battle of Edge Hill in October, the Royalists advanced on London, but they were halted at Turnham Green in November. Charles then established his capital at Oxford, and the Earl of Essex, commander of the main Parliamentarian army, was ordered to take Oxford. On April the 27th, he captured Reading, but there he would remain until mid-May, claiming he was unable to advance because he needed more supplies and more money. What military commander is not going to use that as a good excuse? Despite the stalemate around Oxford, Royalist success elsewhere provided an opportunity for another shot at a decisive victory. In the southwest, Royalist commander Sir Ralph Hopton had secured Cornwall with victories at Braddock Down in January, before inflicting a serious defeat on Waller's Army of the Southern Association at Roundway Down on July the 13th, battles that we've already looked at. Arguably the most comprehensive Royalist victory of the war. It isolated the Parliament's garrisons in the west. Reinforced by troops from Oxford under Prince Rupert, July the 26th, they captured Bristol, gaining the second largest city in Britain. Now, despite this, Royalist forces were significantly depleted by the battle at Bristol, suffering 1,000 dead and exhausted all their supplies, which forced their armies to regroup. Even considering this, the capture of Bristol is a considered high watermark of the Royalist cause during the First English Civil War. With the city captured, an immediate dispute occurred over who was going to govern it, and this led to Charles traveling there on August the 1st to take personal command of the Royalist forces. When he arrived, he called his council of war together to discuss their next move. And the main question at hand was whether the armies should be united and march in one on a new design, and then what should that design be? Now, the Western Army, although still strong, refused to advance further east due to the presence of Parliamentarian forces within Dorset and Cornwall. The army's commanders felt that if they tried to push such a move, their forces would either mutiny or desert. As a result of this unrest, it was quickly resolved that the Western Army would remain an independent fighting force and simply remain in Dorset and Cornwall to mop up the remaining Parliamentarians. Accordingly, the Western Army, commanded by Lord Carnarvon, remained in the region, capturing Dorchester in a bloodless victory on August the 2nd. Prince Maurice left 1,200 infantry and about 200 cavalry to garrison Bristol before marching to Dorchester and personally taking command. The greater issue was what to do with the Oxford army and what the next design of the Royalist campaign would be. Now, Rupert's strategy was to advance through the Severn Valley and capture Gloucester, which would allow Royalist forces in South Wales to reinforce Charles's army, thus allow for an assault on London. But another faction, however, argued that London could be captured with the army as it was, and that Gloucester would simply serve as a distraction from the main goal of the campaign. Well, by August 6th, it was clear that Rupert's strategy would be abandoned. Instead, an alternative means of capturing the city was considered. During the early stages of the war, the loyalty of combatants on both sides, particularly that of professional soldiers, had been, shall we say, flexible? Gloucester was led by Edward Massey, a nonpartisan mercenary who took a job with the Parliamentarians after he was refused a significant Royalist command. At the same time, it was felt that it was a strong, if so far silent, party of the Royalist sympathizers in the city. While the governor of Sudley Castle was reporting that Gloucester's soldiers had stated they would not resist a royalist advance. Given this, the Council of War decided, go ahead, march on Gloucester. Not to besiege it or to capture it by force, but to capture it by having the governor betray the city beforehand. Old tactic. William Legge, who had served with Massey in the Bishop's Wars, contacted him and asked him to surrender Gloucester to his lawful sovereign. Although this message was rebuffed, Legge's messenger reported that he had met Massey a second time in secret and had been asked to tell Legge that Massey was willing to surrender the town to the king. As a result of this, on August the 7th, Charles and the Oxford army marched on Gloucester. Now, Charles's main force, marching on August the 7th, reached the village of Penswick a day later. However, Rupert's cavalry screen had already advanced and taken the village. Charles himself did not accompany the force, but instead rode across the Cotswolds to Rendcomb, where he met reinforcements from Oxford on August the 9th. On the morning of August the 10th, the Royalist army marched to Gloucester itself and besieged the city with approximately 6,000 infantry, 2,500 cavalry. With the force assembled, Charles sent a group of heralds, escorted by 1,000 musketeers, forward at approximately 2 in the afternoon, at which point they read out the king's demands to a meeting of the 26 local council and garrison officers, including Massey. The king's announcement was that if the officers submitted, he would pardon all officers, prohibit his army from causing any damage to the city, and leave only a small garrison behind. If they did not, he would take the city by force, and the inhabitants would be responsible for all the calamities and miseries that would befall them. Despite earlier claims that Massey would surrender, he did not. A short time later, a refusal of the offer was drawn up and unanimously signed by the officers. The reasons for Massey's failure to surrender the city, despite the feelers put out by royalist contacts, even to this day is still unknown. At this point, Charles called another council of war to discuss the situation. It was resolved that it was crucial that Gloucester still be taken. Were left in parliamentarian hands, it would act as a break in the lines of communications should the royalists advance further east towards London. In addition, Charles's personal reputation had been sullied. Traveling so far and yet not taking Gloucester would have impact on the respect and prestige accorded to him, about which he was always notoriously sensitive. Based on reconnaissance, Charles's officers were confident that the garrison's food and ammunition wouldn't last long. They argued the city could be taken in less than 10 days. With Parliament lacking an effective army to relieve the city, if Essex's forces did not attack, the royalists would take the city. If they did attack, they would be exhausted, and according to royalist intelligence, far weaker than the Oxford army, allowing Charles to destroy Parliament's one remaining significant force. Under the direct command of the Earl of Forth, the royalists laid siege to the city. Rupert suggested a direct assault, but this was not adopted due to the fears of high casualties. By August the 11th, the royalist trenches were dug, the artillery prepared, and despite Massey's attempts to disrupt the work with musket fire, it was unsuccessful. With this work done, there was no way out for the parliamentarians. The only hope was to delay the royalists long enough for a relief army to arrive. To this end, Massey ordered raids under the cover of darkness, with James Harkis, his second-in-command, leading a raid on the artillery trenches. In revenge, the royalists attacked the east of the city, but were driven off by cannon fire. August the 12th saw more raids, this time during the day, which cost the royalists 10 men and a supply depot, with no parliamentarian losses. Despite this, the assaults did not disrupt royalist preparations, and by evening they were able to start bombarding the town. By August the 24th, the royalists, suffering from shortfalls in their stocks of gunpowder and cannonballs, remained unable to breach the walls. Essex, in the meantime, had been urgently preparing his army, which, thanks to disease, indiscipline, and desertion, now 6,000 infantry and 3,500 cavalry. This was not a force strong enough to defeat the royalists, so he demanded an extra 5,000 men. Parliamentarians in London responded by mobilizing a brigade of the London trained bands. That provided an additional 6,000 men. Taking into account additional problems and desertions, the eventual force was 9,000 infantry and 5,000 cavalry. After being mustered at Hounslow Heath, the army began marching towards Aylesbury, arriving on August the 28th. This force was formally mustered on August the 30th. After being reinforced by Lord Grey on September the 1st at Brackley, they marched to Gloucester. On September the 5th, with heavy rain falling, the Parliamentarian army reached the town and camped on Prestbury Hill, immediately outside it. Their presence forced the Royalists to abandon the siege, given that neither army, wet and exhausted, was in a state to seek battle. Now, Charles's cautious failure to directly assault the town, putting a higher priority on minimizing losses than on victory, cost the Royalists dearly. While claims of their number in dead wounded range from 1,000 to 1,500, only around 50 people inside the city were killed. Essex's force, on the other hand, was relatively good shape. Its one issue was lack of supplies. If he stayed in the Severn Valley, Essex would be unable to get reinforcements or outside aid. The London elements of the army would demand to go home, and the one remaining significant Parliamentarian force would find itself pinned down, while Charles, with secure bases at Oxford and Bristol, would be able to starve them into surrender, while other Royalist armies ran rampant through Britain. Because of this, Essex had no choice but to try and return to London, traveling back across the Cotswolds as he had done to reach Gloucester initially. This would expose the Parliamentarians to Charles's cavalry in open ground. So we're in the position here where they would have liked to have had the battle outside of Gloucester, but the weather and everything did not help out. So the battle that's going to be fought at Newbury is going to be the result of Essex retreating, and we'll have that part of it next time. Now, the sources for this: History of England by Thornton, Lockyer, and Smith; Cavaliers and Roundheads, The English Civil War, 1642-1649 by Hibbert; English Civil War, 1640-1660 by Warden; English Civil War, 1642-1651 by Gaunt; and The English Civil War, Atlas and Concise History of the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, 1639-51 by Lipscomb. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. Ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.